My name is Eric Jewell. I'm the product lead for Levi's, and designing for a sustainable future is really inherent to our department. Levi's has always been a company that has challenged conventional wisdom because it always believed that business could be a source of economic wealth and social change. My passion, our passion, is in the intersection of design, sustainability, and business. And I think you've seen some proof points over the last year and a half with our waterless Levi's platform, as well as this building, which is insulated with 25,000 pair of Levi's jeans. But tonight is all about brevity. So I'm going to turn it over to Caroline from the Commonwealth Club to get the evening started. Welcome to Levi's.
Thanks for getting us started. Like you said, my name is Caroline Moriarty-Sachs. I'm the director of Inforum. Welcome to tonight's program. I'm not going to take very much of your time, but I want to say thank you to each of you for coming out for our experiment in a format that we have never done before. We have seven speakers here tonight to help answer the question, how to design a sustainable future. Inforum, if you don't know who we are, is a division of the Commonwealth Club to connect your intellect. We host speakers on every different topic under the sun, and we bring them together under one roof to ask them your questions. Your questions are going to come at the last 15 minutes of the program. We have a mic in the aisle. You'll line up and ask questions that are actually questions. They'll be short and sweet. If you want to tweet the event tonight, we're using the hashtag InForumSF. If you want to find out more information about us, you can go to commonwealthclub.org/InForumSF. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. But tonight, we're here to bring together seven amazing speakers. Without further ado, I'm going to go ahead and welcome the founder of Pachacacha San Francisco, Paul Jamtgaard, which will kick off tonight's event. Thanks for coming.
Thank you, Caroline. And thank you, Levi's, and thank you, Commonwealth Club, for allowing Pachacacha to, you know, expose ourselves, so to speak, to a whole new audience. I just want to say a few things about Pachacacha. First of all, we didn't start here in San Francisco, but we managed to do the second most events in the entire world. It started in Tokyo. It's a global thing. This isn't just a little local endeavor. And it's an important thing to what we're doing because we like the fact that this is grown out of every single community that it encounters. And it's a grassroots event that was started by two friends of mine that are architects in Tokyo. And they were sitting around one day and they said, I want to share what I'm doing with friends, but I know how designers continue to ramble on, hence the format. These slides are here just to show you how it's grown. And it's grown with no pushing whatsoever. It's people like you saying, that looks great. I had a great experience. I want to go home and start something like this. So in 2006, it was a little handful. 2007, it looks like it was about 150. Right now, there's over 450 cities doing Pachacacha around the world. There's probably 20 in the state of California alone. Which, if you go to our website, wherever you might be, it'll locate where you are and point you to the nearest event. We've got people who are Pachacacha tourists who basically will look at a vacation, go out on the website, and match up their dates with events. We find that it's an amazingly effective way to, almost like a paratrooper, drop behind enemy lines right into the center of a design community. So tonight you're going to learn something that is almost like a little password. Everybody applies their best phonics to say Pachacucha, but... Mark Ditham, an Englishman living in Tokyo now for 25 years, he's customized this word to his own liking, and this is how you say it. Pe-chak-cha. Repeat after me. Pe-chak-cha. That's all it takes. This is Mark. This is Astrid. These are the founders, and they look like very severe designers. This is a picture that I think Vogue Japan had shot with them because they opened some really sexy boutiques. But... the next image will sort of reveal their true selves. This is how they really are. This is how they can come up with an event that is really about play. It's about the exchange of ideas back and forth from people. It's not a speech that is delivered in a one-directional fashion. They set this up so that people could reach out and meet with those people who are out there expressing big ideas and little ones as well. My conversion experience took place in Tokyo when I met some of the top designers in the UK who were there on it was a design fair. They all were there, and I found myself talking to people like Thomas Heatherwick and Richard Rodgers, and, you know, who expects to kind of find yourself talking to them at the end of an evening? So this slide is really an invitation for all of you who've got a creative spark to come contact us at pataketa.org. Find us here in San Francisco, participate. We do these events almost every month. Sometimes there are special events like this. Other times we do them at a place called 330 Rich down in the south of Market. And it's down and dirty and very informal and very open and a great time to be had by everyone. So without further ado, I want to get onto this evening's program and introduce our first speaker. This evening, we're going to start out with some of the who has engaged one of the bigger ideas that I think man has been grappling with for a long time. Since we started designing, we've been designing, whether it's architecture or clothing or whatever, to protect us from nature, to get us out of the way of nature, because we've got our frail little bodies. Right now, I think it's time we kind of got over ourselves and started listening to nature. And our next presenter, how you doing back there? Okay. Our next presenter is leading the way to express all the wisdom that nature holds. Please give a very warm welcome to Briony Schwan.
Hi. So, how do we design a sustainable future? It's really simple. We need to look at a sustainable system that's been on Earth for 3.8 billion years and thriving. What we need to do is get out of our heads, get out of our offices, and go outside and look at the brilliant design strategies that we find in nature. Tonight, I'm going to titillate you with a few examples. Nature's been on the planet for 3.8 billion years. Life has been here. It does chemistry, manufacturing, architecture, material science, all of the things that we as humans need to do, but it does it sustainably, without polluting the planet, without squandering resources, and mortgaging its future. So here's some examples. The bullet train in Japan had a problem because it created a sonic boom when it went into a tunnel. The engineer that was tasked with solving that challenge happened to be a birder and noticed the kingfisher. And what he did is mimic the shape of the kingfisher's beak, which not only solved the challenge, it designed a train that went 15% faster with 10% more energy efficient. The humpback whale. Whale power has mimicked the turbicles on the humpback whale's leading edge fin to create a wind turbine that is much more efficient. It's able to produce electricity in much lower wind velocity. That's mimicking nature's form and shape. We also mimic nature's chemistry. A company called Columbia Forest Products wanted to figure out how to make oriented strand board or wood composite boards without off-gassing formaldehyde and other toxic pollutants into the air environment. So what they did is mimic the glue of the blue mussel, which is not only incredibly strong, but it's obviously very waterproof. So that's an example of nature's chemistry. Another great example is spider web. Spiders make a compound or a material that's five times stronger than steel, but they do it using dead flies and crickets. What do? We make things like Kevlar that use high heat and toxic chemicals and end up being 95% hazardous waste. But it's not just nature's form or nature's chemistry that we need to look at. It's at the intricate relationships that we see in nature. There's no such thing as waste in nature. What is waste to one organism is a feedstock to another. Companies are just starting to get this and design closed-loop systems. This is a diagram of life's principles. What these are the deep patterns that we see throughout living organisms on the planet. And there are many of them that give us these lessons. But the most important one and the overarching one is that life creates conditions conducive to life. And that's the fundamental design principle that we need to do when we're designing. Here's a great one. Nature always uses the least amount of energy possible. When we design ceramics, we use high heat and lots of chemicals. The abalone makes a ceramic that's much stronger than any ceramic we make, and yet it does it in a self-assembly process in ambient seawater temperatures, and it's much more beautiful than anything we make. Engineers at Arup have designed a building in Harare, the Eastgate building, that mimics the structure, the internal structure of a termite mound. Termite mounds maintain the same indoor temperature regardless of the extreme variations in temperature in the exterior. So by mimicking that, they're able to make buildings that don't need air conditioning units or heating units. Color, another important part of design features. Unfortunately, color can be very toxic with the pigments that we use in textiles and paints. Nature makes these incredibly vibrant colors by using structural color by simply reflecting light waves. And you'll see next, on the next slide, a company called Morphotex, mimicking the Morpho butterfly, that is making a fabric, a Morpho fabric. Another company called Qualcomm is now using this new technology to design computer screens and cell phones using that same reflective technology that can be seen in the outdoors. So amazing stuff that's happening with structural color without using those pigments. By looking also at the ubiquitous patterns that we see in nature, we can solve a lot of design challenges. PAX Scientific, right from here in the Bay Area, designs PAX fans and propellers that, depending on the application, use 30 to 70% less electricity than most traditional fans and propellers. And given fans and propellers account for about a third of the world's energy, that's pretty significant. When we do materials, that chip packet has multiple layers of materials, making it impossible to recycle. Every time we want to create a new structural function, we tend to create a new polymer as humans. Nature uses 5 basic polymers and makes exquisite structures using only 5 polymers. And then what do? We make materials that last forever. Make a water bottle that goes into a landfill for hundreds of years. Nature uses a process called time degradation, where the material, after its useful life, breaks down and biodegrades back into its base materials. This is a company called Vitalis, who wanted to figure out how to make a much lighter weight water bottle so it could be more sustainable and make less plastic. What they did is mimic the structural shape, so it's fitting form to function, of the white pine bark, which has to resist incredibly strong winds. So you can see that it has that spiral shape. This is, on the bottom corner, is a lotus leaf. And you'll notice many leaves in nature have self-cleaning surfaces. Those little nano bumps cause the water to ball up and take dirt with it. And so companies are now using this technology to create self-cleaning paints, self-cleaning glass, as well as textures on buildings. This is an amazing little creature called the namib beetle, which is able to take water from mist in the air. And companies are now mimicking this process. Can you imagine every building in San Francisco with the surface on it that we would extract all the water we need just from our building surfaces? An amazing biomimicry story is Interface Carpets. Not only have they made a biomimetic carpet tile, which has a long story of itself, which I'll tell you at drinks, but they are using biomimicry throughout their company so that by 2020 they'll have a zero negative environmental impact. And my final slide is about a process that we're now working on called ecological performance standards, where we take it much to a much higher level. How do we design our cities so they mimic the ecosystems that they're in? How do they absorb water, collect water, create soil, sequester carbon in the same way that the ecosystem is that that city is built in? Thank you.
Wow. You know, as an architect, every time I kind of hear those ideas and see those images, it just makes me want to go back and start over. And hopefully it's making a lot of people feel that way. I think those first principles and those first instincts are the things that are going to set us in the right direction. I think there's a major correction that needs to happen. Few people manage to follow those first instincts. Our next presenter is somebody who really kind of confronted that question, what am I going to do with my life and how am I going to do it for good? So we started a magazine by the very same name. Please give a very warm welcome to Max Schur.
All right, we're here. There's a big question in front of us. How do we design a sustainable future? And I don't have the answer. I'm sure that you guys are unfolding answers, but this question is huge. Why do we need to do it? This is the most precious thing that we have. And this is just a beach with litter on it. And Wendell Berry, wrote, there are no unsacred places, just sacred places and desecrated places. And, you know, we see the world as we leave it. And I went to the beach in Malibu, and I saw this stenciled on the wall. It said, "Only fools litter," and it just kind of spoke to me more than a stencil. It was this profound statement. It was so true. And yet, how do we cultivate that wisdom? I really like this great Zen master said, benefiting others and benefiting oneself are like two wings of a bird. I think that's the key. How do we align our self-interest with this solution, this great big solution that we need? And the 20th century, the way we've been operating, this is a bird that ate some of our waste in this Pacific gyre. And, you know, that's the bird of the 20th century. That's the world that we're leaving. And this is a great piece by Chris Jordan, a photographer. You know, so John Muir, a local hero, came here from Scotland, helped us create these national parks. And, you know, thank you for John Muir. But he didn't do it for us. He did it because that's what made him move. And we're so grateful for him. You go to the national parks, you go to the Muir Woods here. It's John Muir. And then Ben Jervey, I met him when we were just brainstorming the first beginnings of good. And he was just this pure ball of energy and just totally committed to the environment. And since I've kind of followed everything he's done, and he wrote a book about how you can live an environmentally responsible life in the city. But how do we let Ben and others like him not be a lost generation? And Valerie Casey, you know, she did this designer's accord. She said to designers, I know you care about sustainability, so let's, you know, make a pledge that when we design something, we'll give the client a sustainable option, even if they don't ask for it. And 100,000 people plus signed up right away, and it just shows designers are on board for this. And Majora Carter said, this shouldn't just be about yuppies and, you know, fancy elitist stuff where you pay a little bit more for green. She said, let's bring this to the South Bronx. This is environmental justice, and this solution needs to be everywhere. And this is Frederick Law Olmsted. I mean, I grew up on a campus that he helped design, and whenever I go to cities where he has work, I like to go there, and it's kind of a good launching pad. I think that's like the headquarters of this movement all around the world. You know, wherever you can find one of his places, it's a good place to think about solutions to this big question. That's not a bad spot. Nature and civilization. And this is Al French, who's doing the Bay Circuit Alliance in Massachusetts. You've never heard of him, but it was a dream of Frederick Law Olmsted's, not just to do the emerald necklace, but an outer emerald necklace. And Al French is making it happen, and it's amazing. And NASCAR is even getting in on the act. And this is solar panels around the Pocono Raceway. And I didn't know what to think of this at first, but it's kind of, okay, NASCAR is trying to get used to this. And that's great because everybody needs to. And it makes sense for them. And this is GE's Eco-Imagination. And it's pretty amazing. It's like, okay, the sun is your very own power station. And what's cool about what GE is doing is they're making money, and it's a big part of their business as they come up with solutions. And then I like what Google's done with this simple equation of RE less than C, this idea of when renewable energy is less than cheaper than coal, we're going to be in a better place. And so it's nice that they're fighting for this. And the Army, it's nice that the Army is fighting for this, and they have the strategy for the environment. And yes, this is a security issue, and it's also they're a huge force for innovation. And General Petraeus said we need to reimagine the contemporary soldier, and that includes all of you, because we need to do this to secure the future, as they say, on the Army website. And this is 350. It's the amount of parts per million of carbon that we can tolerate in the atmosphere to not ruin the planet, and we're over it already. And this organization based here is getting people all together all around the world to do something about it. It's very, very cool. And when I think about what I can do about it, this is what's necessary for my sustainability. I need to exercise, I need to sleep, I need to meditate, and I need to eat well. And when I do that, I feel like I can start to make a little contribution. And then last century, we brought all the brightest minds in the world together, and this was the challenge of the 20th century. We needed to create this. And so right now, it's, you know, time to do a new Manhattan Project and to figure out how we create a sustainable future. Thank you.
Thanks, Max. Yeah, that's not too big an issue, is it? No, good thing all of us are in on it. And the thing I like about good is that it kind of makes it. It's one of those vehicles that's going to help make this the new normal. If NASCAR starts putting photovoltaics around their tracks, a big segment of the country that maybe is skeptical about why they're doing it is going to be confronted and recognize that there's some fundamental wisdom. And if we can start to make lots and lots of incremental changes, that's going to make a huge difference. I think another thing that's really important is to tap into those energies that are flowing through our society, and the economy is just one of those. And some small businesses are able to take that and leverage it and move those ideas forward. Our next speaker is one who has basically embraced that to a very successful career now in local manufacturing, one that reflects the lifestyle of the people or the community lives in, and provide lots of great opportunities for people. And so I would like to have you give a very warm welcome to our next presenter, Mark Dwight.
Thank you very much. Good evening. I am Mark Dwight. I am a local entrepreneur, designer, and maker of things, and I have a very small business called Rickshaw Bagworks out on the Dog Patch. And I make things, and many people would find that objectionable and unsustainable in and of itself. But in the making of things, I have tried to make it my mission to make things better. We like to say that we are the only species with the power to change the world. Now, I don't know that I'm going to change the world with my bags at Rickshaw Bagworks, but I do think that some of the things that we practice at Rickshaw are good examples of how you can go back to where you're living and working and playing every day and think about how you can make incremental changes. We have a bag called the Zero, and that was it on the screen before there. The Zero was designed very elegantly to be made from four rectangles of fabric. A roll of fabric is nothing but a long rectangle, so if we could fit all those rectangles into a big long roll of fabric, we could use it all up. And so the idea was to eliminate or minimize the waste in the process of making our bags. So here's a picture of our bag before it's assembled. It's four rectangles of fabric. Those rectangles can be scaled for any size of bag we want and any width of fabric that we use. And when we cut a little profile of the flap, we use the pieces that are left over in the construction of the bag. So we try and keep everything together. And what few little scraps are left, we can tuck into a fold in the bag and keep it all together. This is important because if we want to recycle things, we don't want waste in the process. So we want to bring everything that we're using along with us, even the little scraps. And so that when the product is at the end of its useful life, and if there is a closed-loop cycle for recycling it, that we can put all of that material back into the recycling process. So this is a very simple example of a product designed for recyclability. Now, things get much more complicated, of course, when we're working with electronic devices and things of that nature. But we need some examples to teach our students so that they can start thinking in this way when they're designing simple and complex products. The next example of sustainable design at my company is coming up on the next slide, an acknowledgement that outdoor advertising today uses a highly toxic material called PVC. PVC is used in just about every advertising banner and billboard that you see in the advertising environment. Here in San Francisco, where we fancy ourselves as one of the greenest cities in the world, I've taken on a project to try and eliminate PVC from the outdoor environment. So this is the use of polyester fabric rather than PVC as the substrate for doing banners in the environment. And we've designed developed a design protocol which really treats this as a canvas, as a fabric canvas, rather than as simply an advertising medium, and teaching designers to think about what this is going to be after it's an advertising message. And so embedding designs in the background that you may not see as a recipient of the ad message, but we'll see later on when you're a recipient of the product that this becomes, whether it's a bag or a piece of apparel or a piece of footwear. So it's anticipating the next life of the banner, rather than thinking of it as simply a disposable message that we're then going to put into the landfill. The irony of PVC is that it's manufactured in a highly toxic process, and ultimately it either finds its way to the landfill, where it decomposes into chlorine and liberates all kinds of ugly materials like lead into the groundwater, or Believe it or not, it's packed up into containers, shipped to China, and used to fire boilers. And all of the gases and the flue gases and the ash end up in the air and in the water and in the ground. So this is an example of how we might rethink the materials that we're using for something else and repurpose them into something new and avoid an environmental problem that we have today. Along the lines of materials, we're also working a lot with recycled polyester. And so polyester can be reformulated once it's been used. Clear plastic bottles can be made into new plastic bottles, but a lot of that material actually is too dirty to use for food-grade plastic, so it goes into the commodity market. These fibers made from recycled polyester can be made into beautiful fabrics. This is us looking at our performance tweed. It's a herringbone pattern that we've developed with a mill down in North Carolina using 100% recycled polyester, and about 80% of this fabric is actually recycled beverage bottles. And so we have a lot of fun with this. This is a fun process where we look at a blanket with literally hundreds of color swatches that we've designed by picking different colors of yarn, and then we develop a seasonal pattern collection out of this. So reusing some of these materials, yes, they are petroleum-based, but this is one virtuous way to use the petroleum that we have rather than burning it up in our automobiles. Lastly, we look at our operation to see where else we're generating waste. And obviously, when we ship things, we generate waste. We all get Amazon boxes every day, and we have this sort of mindless process of taking what we've ordered out of the box and throwing the box away. We don't even really think about it. Well, we decided that we would treat our shipping container as a product. And so that product is actually a zippered bag that we originally designed to be a bag that goes inside of our bag. And then we decided instead, let's have consumers send them back. And the funniest thing happened. People started communicating with us with the package that we had sent with them, because they send it back to us and they send us love notes, candy, little stuffed animals, all kinds of funny things come back in the round trip shipper. So this package can be reused continually. These can be used hundreds and hundreds of times. People don't use any cardboard boxes, and they have fun communicating with us. So it's become a great consumer engagement tool as well. So these are just four examples of how in our little tiny company in San Francisco, we're using the concepts of sustainable design and manufacturing to try and make our little difference in the world. We are the only species with the power to change the world, so let's change for good. Thank you.
You know, I love it when an idea starts to repeat itself, and I don't know how many of you caught this, but he didn't use the word biomimicry once. But everything he expressed there was basically recognizing that nature doesn't make waste. Nature makes steps that follow into other things. And I think embracing those things in the way that he did, and it's in a purely profit-driven, sensible kind of business model, is exactly the kind of model that's going to take us forward. Now, for our next presenter, I have to confess, when she was first mentioned as somebody to present, I didn't know who she was. And when I realized what she does, the place she's created, I realize it's because I don't own a piece of dirt. Because everybody I talk to who had a backyard, has a little garden, have a rooftop terrace or anything like that, knows what she does. Because what she is doing right now with her own business is creating a sustainability that permeates the entire urban setting. It goes beyond just the garden. It goes into our lives, and it goes into enriching people in ways that most people don't recognize gardens can do. Her name is Flora Grubb, and she has a company name of the very same name, and she's going to tell you a lot more about it right now. Please give her a warm welcome.
Hi, thank you. I'm Flora Grubb, and I'm co-owner of Flora Grubb Gardens, which is an urban garden store here in San Francisco. Here's my beautiful store. It's always bathed in golden light, as you see it in this photo. We guarantee that. So we're an urban garden center. When I went to open my store, I lived in the Mission District, and I wanted to open something in the south side of town where I lived. And we went to look for a location, and we had our first store there for 4 years before we moved out to the Bayview, which is where we are now. And I'm an urbanite, and I live an urban lifestyle. And of course, as we all probably know, that's the way our planet has to go in order for us all to fit on the planet. We all have to live in cities, it seems, and if we're going to leave enough room surrounding our cities to have the beautiful beautiful things happen that happen on this planet without us, or despite us. And so we are an urban garden center, and we make a real effort to help the people that live in cities connect with nature in ways that are meaningful to them. And for me, connecting with nature is what I need to do in many different ways and on lots of different scales in order to stay fortified to do the work that I do. I have a 3-year-old son and 25 employees, and I need some very deep nature in order to keep going. So I go to Mount Tam and I lie in the grass and I let the bugs crawl on me and I watch the wind blow around. But I can only do that once every 3 weekends or so if I'm lucky. And most of the people who come in and shop at my store also aren't able to get out and be bathed in nature in these ways that we find incredibly rejuvenating and restorative. And so we started playing around at the store with these much, much smaller ways of connecting to nature, of small ways that you can connect to nature when you're sitting at your desk, staring at your computer and the walls around you. And I started creating these little tiny gardens, as I call them, when I had my baby, and suddenly there was really no time left for me to even get out into my garden and dig my fingers in and relate to nature in the way that I love to so much. So I started creating these little tiny things, which for me are an entire garden, and it's an experience it's having a relationship with something that's natural and that's green and that's very small. We now do all of these funny things with plants at the store, where we're constantly trying to find different ways to cram plants into every little nook and cranny of people's lives and hang things on walls be involved in sticking little urban parks into little empty slots of concrete and do whatever we can to allow urbanites to connect with nature, because not only is it incredibly important for all of us who feel the lack of that natural interaction when we don't get it, but most of us, I'm guessing or making a broad generalization, grew up in the kind of suburb that I grew up in. I grew up in Austin, Texas. And when I grew up there, there was a lot of ambient nature, feral nature, as I now call it, which is just empty lots and scroungy little creeks. And where the path where I walked to school every day was a natural place. And that's where I learned to love nature. And that's where I developed the very strong bond with the natural world that now drives me to do the work that I do, both in creating beauty in gardens, but also in being clear that participating being part of the cultural shift that we're all a part of must take place. And children growing up in cities aren't going to have that same experience. They aren't going to be exposed to that same scroungy ambient nature that where I made my first real connections with the natural world. And so we're going to need to find for them other ways that they can learn to care for little green things and learn that little green things need their care. And that if they can learn that little green things need their care, then they can extrapolate that big green things are going to need their care as well. And so to raise the next generation, the next army of environmentalists, we've got to be sure that the young people that are going to grow up in cities are getting connected to the natural world in ways that are really significant for them. And we're going to have to cook that up for them. It's not going to be there for the taking in the way that it was for most of us as when we were growing up. So I continue on my mission with my silly little retail store. I mean, I'm just a retailer, and it's a little garden store, and we have coffee, and yet I really believe that the more that I can help connect people to a real personal experience of connection to the natural world, the more that we become extremely protective of the incredibly valuable thing that we have that matters so much to our future survival. So I didn't time to my slides, so I think I'm done. Thank you.
This little garden store. If you've ever been there, it's so much more than a little garden store. And I mean that seriously, because she mentioned coffee. It's not a pot of coffee. It's engaging our culture and making a place for it to thrive, for people to connect in a way kind of like Pachacacha. So people can kind of gather around an interest, exchange ideas, get inspired, and try things that they didn't know they could do or didn't know that their place could support. And it's that kind of endeavor that's going to make the difference. You know, I'm old enough to know when ecology was big, and it was a weird thing that hippies did. And it was easily rejected and isolated because it was foreign to the mainstream. By spreading it wide, by recognizing that it's more than just technology or ecology in the narrow natural sense, but sustainability in the sense of culture, that this is going to take root. It's going to continue to flourish. We're all going to get with it. Like she said, there are going to be children who are raised with this as normal, and that's going to be what's essential. It's not the crazy thing. It's the thing. And our next presenter is somebody who, well, I looked at what she did when we were preparing for this, and I looked at it, and I said, great food, great lifestyle, great community. I asked her what she wanted me to say about her tonight in introduction. She said sustainability, and I realized those three things make for that. So please give a very warm welcome to Nikki Henderson.
All right, everybody, quick before my mind starts. Raise your hands, wiggle your fingers. Come on, who's with me? Lean this way, lean that way. Okay, shake your shoulders out. Y'all needed an energizer. I could tell. All right, I'm ready. Go for it. So, imagine me back in college learning about sustainability. I had no idea what this word was. This is what I learned that it was. Ecology, economy, and equity. The three of those things combining. Now, being the only black person in a statewide organization was a bit weird for me when I was thinking about equity. And what really does this mean? Equity. Because everybody talks about the earth. Food was the way that I found that equity. Because all over the world, there are people that are hungry. And all over the world, that solution is destroying nations' economies with imports and trades. And all over the world, that means putting women into slavery, because they were the ones who grow the food. And so when I came back to Oakland, after traveling a bit to really see what this looks like, People's Grocery was what hit me. A radical, grassroots, scrappy little organization in West Oakland that decided to drive around the neighborhood with a hip-hop truck and sell food, because that was how we were going to actually tap into people who couldn't afford produce over Chef Boyardee or over something that was actually going to feed them long-term. And one thing that we came to when I tried to figure out what was actually going to bring people together and solve the basic problem that causes poverty is that we need to work together and we need to cook together. Over the next few slides, you're going to see examples of people eating together and cooking together. And one of the reasons why we prioritize this at People's Grocery is because West Oakland is a place that has had a long history of people working to solve their own problems, right? It was the neighborhood where the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, the first union that was African-American to be recognized by the National Union Federation. It was the founding area of the Black Panther Party. It was the founding area of the West Oakland Food Cooperative in the late 70s that people tend not to know about. West Oakland is a place where people have always come together to say, what's wrong? Let's fix it. Something that's broken down over time when it comes to people solving their own problems is social cohesion. Things that we used to get for free because of strong social networks have been broken apart with the wealth gap, with the environmental problems, with so many of the things that happen. So if we want to do sustainability really, we have to rebuild social networks. And one of the best ways to do that is through food. It's a great shot of our board of directors. They would be very upset at me if they knew that I was showing this picture. But rebuilding through food means bringing people together and training all of us to be better stewards of our community. And being stewards of the community means being stewards of the land, being stewards of the children, being stewards of the culture, being stewards of the stories, and really being stewards of the history. One of the great ways to do that, to be a real steward, is to build a place. So when People's Grocery brings all these people together, we try to build at least one place that can demonstrate what sustainability looks like on the ground and with the people. And this is our California Hotel Garden. It's in the California Hotel, which was a housing cooperative. Well, it is now a housing cooperative, but it's been through this long history of being low-income housing. The people got threatened with eviction at some point. Then they won the case. They got to stay. We came back there to put a garden because low-income housing structures, especially when they're in hotels, can get a little grody. But if you put a garden in the back and you bring children there and bouncy houses and chickens and goats and a greenhouse and a mural, people say, I'm not going to go there to get drugs anymore. And they don't. The California Hotel has become this beautiful place where brown people and black people come together, where children come, where the residents are now taking leadership, not only in the garden, but with building their community when it comes to their own personal health. And bringing it back to social cohesion, these are all of the things that are actually going to build the types of networks that can once again take over society. This is a beautiful picture of the chickens. We have one rooster because it's legal to have a rooster in Oakland, but I think it should be illegal to have roosters as mean as the rooster is that we have. Anybody have chickens? Have a rooster? Roosters are really a lot to handle, but it is a very, very good community building technique. Yeah, the rooster is not in this pot. That was not, it was not on purpose there. One of the things about what I just said is that when you build community and you bring people together, you tend to feel good, right? Especially if you're boiling the rooster. But what does all this feel-good stuff actually lead to? It has to lead to results, and it has to lead to concrete things for the people who live there. So one of the concrete things that People's Grocery has built over time is People's Community Market, because West Oakland is an area without a lot of grocery stores and thus without a lot of food access. So People's Community Market is our for-profit sister organization that will actually be serving the community and providing fresh and healthy food while we do the education side of things. Highland Hospital is the public hospital where you go if you don't have health insurance in Oakland. And our Produce Box program has now gotten into their pediatrics clinic so that children dealing with childhood obesity and other diet-related diseases can receive a grub box, which is our produce box, over a six-month period and work with their parents to help cook fresh produce in the home. This is the alliance. We don't really have a picture yet, so I just had to show something about people coming together. But we have an alliance between People's Grocery, the United Food and Commercial Workers, environmental justice organizations, and a few other organizations to really design the food retail arena in Oakland, because food retail is one of the things that's actually elevating now when it comes to the economy, and we want to make sure that it's good food and good jobs for people. But with all of these projects, what is that actually going to lead to? That's going to lead to national results. So very recently, Michelle Obama released the second healthy food financing announcement that she did. That is a picture that I took, which I'm very proud of. People's Grocery got invited to the White House to hear Michelle Obama talk about what the private sector is going to do to solve the food insecurity crisis. And we were really, really happy to be recognized, not just because our egos were stroked by getting a chance to sit in the same room as the First Lady, but because community-based efforts are actually being recognized as a real solution. Because at the end of the day, it is about building community. You can drop a grocery store in the middle of a community, but it's not going to solve any problems unless the people there offer ownership of it and unless everybody comes together to really work on the solution and rebuild that social network that is going to allow the rest of us to actually change the world. Thank you.
Nikki, you rock. That was great. And I got to say, you know, all the presentations so far this night have been fantastic, but that was one that just popped into my mind of how much can come across with 20 slides in 6 minutes and 40 seconds. A lot of people come in thinking, oh my God, I really have to cut down, but there's a great example about how much can come across. Now, our next presenter is somebody who seems to have led his entire career with a passion for the beautiful, a passion for the common sense, a passion for justifying design. It's led him into a lot of great different things, and I think it's opened the eyes to a lot of people to what good design looks like. And he's followed that up with another big lesson for people of what it means to live in a city. Now, all those cryptic messages are going to be kind of revealed to you when I give the introduction to our next presenter, Mr. Rob Forbes.
See, how do you do this? When thinking about sustainability, a topic that's way above my pay grade, cities came to mind. For the first time in history, the majority of global population are living in cities, living much more densely together, And so I figured this is the greatest opportunity for terrific impact. In the U.S., we face a particular challenge because as a car-based culture, we've propagated kind of urban sprawl. And we need to think about how to, cars aren't so compatible with cities. It gets a little messy out there. And we need to think differently about how we treat our urban environment. There are three areas that I want to talk about. Art, briefly. Art and design, food, and bikes. A single art museum in the town of Bilbao, Spain, completely rejuvenated a single city, bringing 1 million people to a town called Bilbao that most people had never heard of before. We have a similar example here with the Herzog and de Meuron and de Jong Museum in Golden Gate Park. Over 2 million visitors a year, a complete home run. Thank you, Walter, for the landscaping. The art can put a very human face on an urban environment. This is Millennium Park in Chicago, where you see more humanity, diversity, people enjoying a public space than any other part in the city. Another example is the High Line in New York, a repurposed elevated railway, which gives New Yorkers and visitors a completely different perspective on the city of Manhattan, again, bringing millions of people into the city, and it's just a terrific place to go and hang out. In our own backyard, we have Crissy Field, which is where dogs and joggers and Texans and Italians and everybody can go and hang out. But a real source of civic pride, a Hargraves-led project. These are big budget projects that take years and a lot of funding and are pretty difficult. Another element that we have in our tool chest, which has been mentioned before, is food. A lot of different parts of San Francisco, I think, have been rejuvenated by food. Ferry Plaza being one, which is a terrific place for both locals and for tourists alike. It wasn't developed by a design firm, unless you take Loma Prieta Earthquakes and Associates. The freeway that lined the Embarcadero, very few people even really knew about Ferry Plaza until we had the earthquake and the courage of Art Agnos and a number of people to tear that sucker down and open up the waterway for the rest of the city. There you'll see a similar development over in Hayes Valley where the Central Freeway ran. They left a couple of remnant parking lots and a project called Proxy Envelope A&D Architects. You're going to see a beer garden over there, and there's an ice cream shop, and there's a coffee place, and there'll be a number of different food concessions that will, I think, transform this little transit center into a gem for the community and something that we can be really proud of. That's kind of just kicking off this year and will generate a lot of excitement. San Francisco can take some pride in leadership. We're converting a lot of pavement into these little parklets, just repurposing spaces for cars. The message is that people are a lot more interesting and valuable than automobiles. You'll see also restaurants around the city that are converting the fronts of their parking areas from cars to bike racks. And the message there, if you're sitting out in a restaurant, you'd much rather look at people and bikes than automobiles. But the food movement has been particularly helpful. I was in Portland last week and saw the same thing. There's a parking lot in the middle of Portland, one flat parking lot, kind of an eyesore. But now it's surrounded by this food court of these wonderful little food trucks. Diversity of food, diversity of people. You go out there at lunch, people are happy hanging out, you meet people. It's had a terrific effect. I have to talk about bikes a little bit. Bikes have had an incredible effect on softening the urban environment. The bike share program that kicked off in Paris about 5 years ago set in motion bike share programs all throughout Europe. We've been slow to catch up on this. We've got a small bike share program in Washington, D.C. One is starting in New York. But it's curious that in San Francisco, where we have a terrific bike coalition and 13,000 members, actually getting change in our city has been much harder. I think it's this behavior modification that we need to think about because we're so wedded to cars and the way that we get around. We've managed to put in a few different bike lanes. You'll see these around the city. But actually, you know, getting change here is kind of like pulling teeth. And it's kind of difficult for me to figure out, given who we are, and we think of ourselves as a very progressive and forward city. But change comes difficult to us. Maybe we're just lazy, or maybe because gasoline is still so cheap. You know, we think we have this in one of the most elegant entrances to any city in the world, and we're pretty good at figuring out ways of getting people into the city. When they get to the city, not so easy and not so much. There are broad expanses of asphalt like this that are remnants to the days when car culture was at its peak that are, like, to me, like blank canvases that are just kind of asking for rejuvenation. And I think you'll see a lot more of this going on in the city. There's a reason why we're meeting in San Francisco and not in Mendocino. You know, cities are the bedrock of our civilization and culture, and it's where democracy will take a place if we're going to have it. And I'd like to thank the Commonwealth Club for being so city-minded. Thank you.
Terrific. Thank you very much. You know, I am always impressed by what people come up and share. And I frankly really like it when people come and share what they're not really known for. Just sharing themselves and what inspires them and the things that sort of resonate. Our next presenter is the only person who I've known for a long time of the ones we've had this evening, and it's always a treat. It's great to sort of see friends who've done amazing, great things. This is a fellow I've known for over 20 years. We first met when I was at UC Berkeley. He had just graduated, and he was teaching and doing amazing things. I'm like, he just graduated. But he's been hot. He's been hot for a long time. He's been doing projects and things you've walked through and you maybe didn't even know it. You saw the De Young Museum and the landscape that he had done for that. But more than those kinds of things, he is working very much in community. He's creating places. He's creating places that connect people not only with themselves but with nature, and raises their attention span and raises their sensibility. And hopefully he'll do the same for all of you tonight. Please give a warm welcome to Walter Hood.
Good evening, and I'm from West Oakland, yeah? Right around the corner from your little place. Tonight I'd like to talk about a couple things. I'm going to show some projects, and I think central to this question for me is that I really like people. You know, I like nature and all that, but I really like people, so I work with people, which is really strange when you talk to environmental designers. People never come up. And one of the things that we like to do is really think about how to change the sociology of space and how to get people to see something different. This first image is of the roof of the Mint down on Mission. Most people didn't know. It's a full story, full parapet height that you could actually go up on there, and it's not historic. And since it's not historic, maybe we can actually bring the marsh back. That during the fire, most of the water that put out the fire was actually pumped up through the Mint because there is an underground stream. But if people knew that at Fifth and Mission, maybe they would walk, maybe they would find the egrets, or maybe they would look and smell the ocean, the bay. Jackson Hole, Wyoming, very urban. You get off the plane, you drive down this beautiful moraine. If there are like elk out there, they're bugling. You go to a museum, it's all parking lots. The last 5 years, we talked them into actually removing a third of their parking. For a museum, a big issue because of the visitor experience. But we got them to actually say, well, maybe people are there for that landscape. And now, instead of seeing a parking lot, you actually see the moraine and you actually see the hole in Jackson. Right? But getting people to walk out there, I was just there the other day, they went, this is amazing. They've been working there for 10 years. And they've never seen that landscape because they were in a parking lot. And Rob showed some great images of things here in the Bay Area on the Embarcadero. In Charleston, if you've been to Charleston, South Carolina, it's really hard to find the water. Billion-dollar crop, Carolina gold, between Africans and colonists actually created this amazing crop there because of water. We actually grew rice there for about 2 months, and we actually made Carolina gold and got people to actually see water. They also saw frogs and blue herrings. which they don't normally see because there's no water, right? And so just this thought of getting people to see where they are changes their perception of place and then hopefully changes their patterns and practices. So maybe one day people will actually walk across the Golden Gate Bridge because there won't be any cars. A big issue we have now in our cities, shrinking cities. I hate that term. Detroit, Cleveland, Pittsburgh, people have left because we've taken all the great stuff out of the city. So people have went to find other great stuff. But those people who are left there in the Hill District here in Pittsburgh, we told them, don't go to the suburbs. You actually have a suburb. So they're actually going to stay there because the value is actually worth more than going to the suburbs. Here in Chicago, epiphytes grow inside of a building. You showed epiphytes earlier. They actually clean the VOCs from all this crap that we have up here. So all the stuff that we're smelling, just a little green goes a long way. But it doesn't have to look like green. Right? In Berkeley, California, this is a street. Wouldn't it be great if a street actually had holes in it, like your skin, that the street could actually breathe? Right, that it could actually let water in when it needed to, or created a hard surface when it didn't need to bring water in. This is a project of bringing back Strawberry Creek. Just because we had a creek doesn't mean the creek is still there. Right, that we can imagine that floodplain in a completely different way to get people to be revelatory about where they live. The creek probably took up a half mile. It moved. So can people move with the creek? So maybe one day you'll go down to Center Street and there'll be a big hole, and there'll be water. Maybe there might even be a salmon in there, right? Community gardens. I used to hate them until Bette Midler called me one day and said, we want to do a community garden in Brooklyn. So working with 50 Cent the Rapper, actually Jamaica Queen, we actually have a singer, two singers, one black, one white, making a community garden for people who look like this. And getting people in the community to actually see something different. It catches water. They don't have to call the fire department to get their water. But they also see the rapper 50 Cent. Every kid comes to that garden looking for 50 Cent. All they get is the postage stamp. But at least they see the food, they see the champagne, they see the water. Rain gardens. How many people know what a rain garden is? If you go out in the rain, you'll see a rain garden. Water draining. We had a job to do a rain garden. But rain gardens are also, they could be culturally significant. So in Pittsburgh, we're suggesting next to the hockey arena to drain the water, but to also talk about the people who were removed from the space because that hockey arena actually wiped out an entire community of people. So we're asking for 7,000 images of people who lived in the hill to make a giant curtain to grace the side of the arena. I hope this video is going to play. And on the way, we found out that the sound is not working. But what you're seeing is this rain garden, and we've been working to actually record different rain songs. Because in this African-American community, this was actually called the Chicago of the East. And so no raindrops keep falling on my head, but a rainy night in Georgia, I can't stand the rain, I want to go outside in the rain. All those great rain songs will actually be triggered when you walk into the space. You'll see all of the images, and this amazing sounds of rhythm and blues singers will actually come out and make you understand the rain and the garden. I don't know if this is my last one, so I'll keep talking. So hopefully this project ties in with the last project, which is a 1.1 megawatt solar array that we won a competition in Buffalo to put at the entrance of their campus. Instead of saying, okay, it's just about energy, we decided to design the entire 20 acres because this used to be a riparian stream valley in which the stream was actually taken out. And so we're trying to put green back into this neighborhood through the solar array. And this project will be on board in a month, and it will actually provide all of the electricity for the suburban dormitories that rink the entire campus. But again, getting people to see their world anew, different, to be more speculative, not to be as practical. We got to take risk. When did we become so boring? Right? We don't need to know everything. We can actually fail, because through failure, great things happen. Thank you so much.
Well done. Walter does not disappoint. So please, let's just give a huge round of applause to every one of them, because they were fantastic. They so delivered. It makes Pachacacha proud. We can do this. They can do this. Now, we're going to have a little commotion right here because we're going to get all of them up here for a little bit of Q&A. And this is just going to be the first stage of a Q&A. We're going to have this, the formal Q&A, a la the Commonwealth Club. See, this is nice execution. And then afterwards, of course, you're probably aware, there's a reception out in the lobby where we can have more Pachacacha-style Q&A, which is you going, finding them, and asking whatever you want. Because half the reason they're here is to talk to you, not just you talking to, or you know what I meant. Oh, come on up, everybody. So if you've got any questions, by all means, there's a microphone there. Raise your hand. I think that there's some handheld mics out in the audience. If you got a hand up, a mic might come to you. They got to go to the mic. They have to earn it then. Okay. So, folks, don't be shy. They haven't been. So, if nobody's going to come up with a question, you all look a little more inquisitive than that. There's the mic. Let her rip. This will be your first little taste of Pachacacha. You might have one in your future.
So, you had mentioned, as far as with food, that eating good food, eating organic food, fresh produce, shouldn't be at a premium, that it should be accessible to people. But the reality is, for most sustainable products or sustainable services right now, they're coming at a premium price, and so they're not accessible to everyone. And I wondered if any of you guys have some thoughts on how to get us from sustainability and organics and all those things that are good for us to have them be accessible to everybody versus the IKEAs and the Kmarts and the Walmarts of the world as our best solution.
Great question. In 15 seconds. Well, one of the reasons why they're not accessible is because right now the government subsidizes bad stuff. And the way the economy has been driven is with efficiency and cheap. And so that's why I tend to rely pretty heavily on the movement, because sustainability can't just be about efficient economic systems. Efficient economic systems will leave people out. But if you have a movement underneath these efficient economic systems that are making sure the human stewardship is happening, then that's the only way everyone's going to be included. We have to ring the bell and say good food needs to be subsidized, not bad food. Good energy needs to be subsidized, not bad energy. But they won't do it because that doesn't cost little money that costs a lot of money. So it's up to us.
That's good enough question, good enough answer to next question.
Thanks so much to all of you for the work that you do and for sharing your stories with us. It was really inspiring. And I'm just wondering if you ever reached a point where you thought to yourself, this might not work, and how you got through that.
The life of an entrepreneur. This might not work. So, I think every day we face, this sort of wall of whether the little things that we're trying to do are really going to make any difference. But I think it's we can't get hung up on that, because it's really all we can do is to try and make the impact that we can and try and inspire others. And so whether you're working in a tiny company or you're just an individual, if you can inspire your friends or your colleagues or your customers to take some inspiration from what you do, then you're accomplishing good.
Bryony?
No, I agree. I have that thought every single day, but really, what is the alternative? And so for me, it's really, I want to die trying. And I think the reality is there's actually more good stuff happening in the world than we really know about, because the mainstream media doesn't really cover all of these stories. And I think there are thousands, millions of these stories happening in communities all over the world, and we just really don't know about it. And so I think it's important. It's just, you have to remember that a waterfall is made up of a million little drops of water. And so every single thing that each one of us does every single day amounts up to a lot. So never give up.
Excellent. Yeah. Here, here, absolutely.
I also just talk about the framework of, so when I was in a teeny little room starting good, basically, the framework wasn't just, it might not work. It was basically like a lot of people telling us what you're trying to do is impossible. And I think there's this nice framework. It's like the entrepreneur's paradox, which I'm sure Rickshaw's kind of put up. Everyone who's starting something has felt this a little bit. Like, to start your own thing and make it happen, it is kind of impossible. It takes defying gravity. And I think it's that framework of, okay, it's going to be really hard, but it can't be stopped. Anyhow.
How boring is it?
This is my mom answer. When you're really scared, try exercising a lot. Go and walk really hard up and down the hills, and then eat well, and then just keep going.
Yeah. Yeah. Max, it was like your chart. Yes.
I think that failure is something that all of us are very conversant in up here. When you're in an entrepreneur, you're a creative area taking risk, a failure really is an option, and you fail often and regularly, so you just kind of get used to it. It's that simple.
Yeah, I think, you know, if I could just throw in 2 cents on this, nature's only method for learning is through failure.
Can I add?
Yeah, go for it.
It's like, you know, when you're like doing any kind of sports or anything and you get butterflies and you get scared. If you're at work and you're doing something that you really care about and there's no fear there, there's something wrong. Right? I mean, that's that internal thing where you're not sure because in a way we don't know. And those are that's when you know you're on the precipice of something. And all of these people, I think, know that.
Very good. Very good. Next question.
Each of you, no doubt, each of you, no doubt, has faced adversity in terms of dealing with someone else who had a different point of view. What gem or gems might you offer all of us in terms of persuading other people to alter their point of view?
Don't all jump at once.
I'll just say love.
Yeah, beautiful.
No, really. I mean, I think, you know, everyone's going to have a different, you know, we're not all the same. But I just think if we had a little bit more respect for one another, and I say love in a way that kind of kindness, that I hear you and I understand. I just differ. And I think through that kind of communication, you can sort of work and find that kind of common ground, and hopefully no one gives something up.
Oh, I like that answer. Yeah. You know, really the way that we've approached this is that there are very, very few differences between people, or at least that's been my experience. Usually the differences are past pain or some kind of trigger. You just have to figure out what they're actually being triggered by, and it's usually not what they're saying. So I feel like convincing someone has never worked in our line of work. We usually have to start by listening, because we get all kind of stuff. Poor people don't want to eat healthier. Or if we work and work and work with someone and then their son gets murdered, they're not thinking about healthy food. They're just thinking about how to wake up the next day. And so I feel like when the realities of life hit, that's when the deep listening comes in. And then no matter who we're talking to, we can usually find some common ground.
Well, we face all kinds of doubting Thomases in our endeavors, and I like to say the difficulty is in the doing. And there's lots of great ideas out there, but the people who actually go out and do something. And, you know, the naysayers be damned. Just get out there and do what you need to do, and if you're onto something, people will follow you, and people will emulate you, and people will praise you for what you're doing. And if it's not quite right, you'll change what you're doing because you'll find out real fast as well.
I was going to take cynical point? So say, you know, you being in the retail world, you make people an offer they can't refuse. But I've always kind of been in the area of kind of asking people to spend a little bit more for quality, for something that will last longer, for something that will endure. And it's just giving that guarantee that if they don't like it, bring it back. But try something, test something, and that seems to work pretty well.
I'll just sort of sum up what I think I heard a lot of other people and say and reiterate that I really think you change people's minds by showing them rather than by telling them.
Excellent. Yeah, you've shown a lot of great stuff tonight, all of you. So next question.
Yeah. Well, this is actually kind of maybe a different take on the same question. In our world now, we really have a scarcity model that's running it, a fear-based model. And clearly, all your solutions that you've been presenting, and they're really fabulous and inspirational, require partnerships. And I wasn't here; they were implied, but I was wondering how that model, through breaking the scarcity model, how you've done that in your lives, or how you've created partnerships.
And
how they've motivated you. You know, anybody can take the
ad. That's a big thing I focus on sort of day to day. But for me, I think alignment is the key. You know, is scarcity when it's like they're two competing things. But if you can find a way to align things, I mean, I brought up that quote of two wings of a bird of benefiting yourself and benefiting others. But I think when you can show a solution that's aligned with, I think self-interest is key, is vital. And when you can align that self-interest to the solution you're looking for, you're in a good place.
I think partnership is inherent to movement theory. And that's one of the reasons why People's Grocery has done the for-profit, nonprofit model. And that was actually why we were invited to hear the Healthy Food Financing Initiative announcement at the White House, because there's been a bunch of recent studies that talk about how food deserts don't actually exist. Low-income people actually live really close to a lot of grocery stores. They just don't buy produce. And so there's this war happening right now about what the cause of food insecurity actually is. And it's not just distance. And so you can't just drop a grocery store and use the market to solve a food insecurity problem. You have to use the nonprofit sector. You have to use the for-profit sector. You have to bring labor into the picture. You have to bring family counselors into the picture. You have to bring community economic development into the picture. And so that's kind of how we've designed our model. And I feel like any of the sectors that we tend to touch doing that, the really, really successful folk have done that. They've either become a separate organization in and of themselves or become an LLC and an umbrella structure. It's pretty widespread, at least from what we see in our work, which is really hopeful.
Yeah, my two cents on the partnership here. We run our own little operation. We're completely nonprofit. We have no cash flow virtually whatsoever. And we try to align ourselves with the needs of whether it's 330 Rich that needs an evening full of people who want to buy beer and provide us a space, or the Commonwealth Club and Levi's who want to tap into a whole different community and a different means of connecting to them. It's, again, bring what you've got, listen to what somebody else wants, look for that little medium that kind of allows you to move forward together. I think that's the way we're all going to move forward together. Next question.
Can I just add one thing?
Yeah, go ahead.
I mean, doing a lot of public work with municipalities, you know, we work with a lot of cities, and I think working with a private client, it's on one hand, it's easy to have a relationship, but with bureaucracies and municipalities, it's really hard. But I found you have to treat them in the same way. Mm-hmm. And so, like, I do a lot of work with the city of Oakland, and I know public works people personally. I mean, I know their family, mm-hmm. you know, and I've been working with them for 15 years. And out of that comes a kind of a sharing. Mm-hmm. Their frustration, but also a trust, where, you know, if you treat it like a business, you know, if we're doing it for all of us, it's just, we're just spitting out the stuff, and no one really cares. Mm-hmm. No one cares if it's going to last. No one cares how much it costs. But I think those relationships are possible.
Excellent. Yeah.
And
thanks.
It's that love thing again, right? That you can actually find a part in. You can find people when you're doing what's aligned with your heart. Then you can find people that you love doing the same thing, yeah. And that makes partnerships pretty pleasant.
Mm-hmm. Great. Another question.
It's very California.
Yeah. Hey, but hopefully it's a very world.
What's the answer to this question? It's love every time. Go ahead. No, it's love again.
Yeah, go ahead.
I feel kind of like a homing pigeon because, believe it or not, in my early 20s, 55 years ago, I went to work for Levi Strauss. I stayed a couple of decades, and, you know, it never leaves you. As you're aware, we have a rather severe unemployment, part-time, full-time in this country. It looks like it might persist for a while. I wonder if some of the very excellent programs that you're developing could be useful for people to either part-time or full-time or something that they can contribute to the community as well as to enhance their own lives.
Fantastic question, yeah.
That is. Yeah. So one of the fun things is starting small. You know, we're now 75 people. We're in the process of hiring dozens more. I think that's what's really fun is creating a growth model where you can hire people. Obviously, that's not going to be the mainstream solution. But we're also teaming up with a couple of partners for things that are just coming out really soon that I can't talk about that are going to be addressing this issue because it's such a huge issue. And I sort of mentioned in my talk that just really briefly this concept of the lost generation. Like it really
gets at me when I keep reading that these 20-somethings who, you know, have often been seen, like they're described sometimes as the most socially conscious generation in the history of the world. And right now there aren't jobs for them, and they're like trained and they're so ready to go, and then they're going back and living with their parents. So I think we really need to figure out that of how do we get the best out of them. You know, we started this company because we believe that you should be able to have a job where you can make money and make a difference. And I really think like that's one of my personal missions now is that everyone in the world should be able to do that. And so, you know, figuring out things that actually work, that's challenged. You know, we're working on that. But I think it's a great question and a huge issue.
You know, it's also a tough question. And I've been thinking about this a lot lately with the change in the economy, and we're starting to sort of get into the political world now. But I actually don't believe there's any shortage of money or resources around. I think it's just very badly distributed. And so I think that's what we really have to think about is how do we redistribute the resources that are. And, you know, from a biomimicry perspective, there is no shortage of redesigning in this world that needs to happen. I mean, we can all walk out of the door and come up with 500 things that we need to redesign differently. And there are plenty of jobs that can be created from that. I think the tough thing is how do we do that in a way where we can restructure those resources to be able to, as somebody said earlier, to put the money into the places where it matters and take it away from the places where it's actually destroying the earth and tearing apart communities and et cetera.
Anybody got one last thing? Because we're going to wrap this up. Make it good.
Yeah.
You've been doing great all night,
wow.
So why not?
No pressure.
Yeah.
I actually wonder if things have to get a whole lot worse, because I agree with you that we are this generation that's really involved in our heads and really want to get involved in the world. But I just got really pissed off and started doing things that were really inappropriate. And it led me to where I am today. And I feel like everyone has to start doing that. And that's the way any good social change has ever happened, is that people got really pissed off and did things that were really inappropriate, like chain themselves to things. I mean, every good movement, the environmental movement that now people look at as this, you know, big green thing that is exclusionary and, you know, they sit with their Big Ten and collude with coal and all of that. They didn't start that way. They kidnapped people. I mean, when I really read the history, it didn't start all pretty. They were really radical, and people didn't listen to them. And so I feel like that's the charge that I try to give everyone when I talk to them, and that's the charge that I try to keep with me all the time, is that nothing is going to change unless we make it change.
Excellent, excellent. Everybody, they did a great job. Give them a very big applause. That's great. So this ends the formal question and answer. We will commence with the informal question and answer. After all those answers, I think you've got a few more questions in mind right now. So go out and misbehave.